everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and you are listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast, where my guest this time is fellow Brit Sam Holliday. Sam is the co-founder of The Race Around, a single and double-handed multi-stage around-the-world race in Class 40 yachts, which is scheduled to take place in 2023. Sam is no stranger to the professional yacht racing scene, having been involved in Vendée Globe campaigns for British skippers Mike Golding and Miranda Merrin, as well as helping run successful Class 40 events like the Atlantic Cup and the Pineapple Cup. Although the race around start isn't until 2023, interest from potential competitors is strong, and as Sam explains in the interview, he and his small but growing team are working flat out right now to get everything in place. Well, Sam Holliday, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. You're talking to me from the south coast of England, where I believe the country's gone into a bit of a panic about petrol. What's going on? About gas?
Yeah. Hi, Justin. Firstly, thanks for having me. Who knows? We're not sure if we're in a fuel shortage or not. All I know is I tried to fill up earlier, and I think I tried three or four different petrol stations before finally giving up. And yeah, who knows if the world's gone mad or not?
Well, the world's definitely gone mad. What we've all been through over the last couple of years with the global pandemic, I think we can expect these sort of strange happenings. But Sam, welcome to the podcast. The reason you're here talking to me is the Race Around, which we're going to get onto in a second. That's a global race in Class 40 yachts, which seems to be getting a lot of traction, and I want to talk to you in detail about that. But before we do that, just tell me a bit about your background. You're a race organizer now, but you've obviously done a lot of sailing yourself as well. So just give us the little potted history of how you did all that.
Yeah, absolutely, and absolutely done a lot of sailing. But I think probably the trick with me was I realized pretty quickly I wasn't very good at it, and decided that, heck, this is a lifestyle and an industry that I love, and how the hell can I stay in it? And really, for me, that was race organization and team management. Offshore sailing has been part of my life for almost my entire life. My father was in the BT Global Challenge in 96, race with Mike Golding. And I've probably been a thorn in Mike's side for, well, 20 years or so, ever since then, working with him as a nipper before moving to France and building a Class 40 with Miranda Merrin and Halvard Mabir, before, yeah, just finding my way to running this round the world race and a couple others that we've got. So a sailor first, but probably a failed sailor.
And was your background in dinghy sailing prior to your father doing that race, or did you kind of get sucked into it through his involvement?
To a certain extent. I mean, there was dinghy sailing on the River Avon. The Cotswolds is where I grew up. Not overly famous for its vast expanses of water, but it was a great place to be. But really, it's for big boats that really captivated me and just went from there. So I did really kind of miss that proper dinghy stage. There was certainly no Olympic pathway or development squad. It was big boats straight to sanding carbon and the pretty rubbish jobs, really.
Sounds like you served your the classic apprenticeship in that world of Imoca 60s and Vendée campaigns and stuff. But I wanted to ask you about your dad's experience, the BT Global Challenge, for our listeners that are not UK-based. Just explain that race, because it is quite unique, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's the brainchild of Shay, and it was really a race that certainly went the wrong way around the world for amateur crews, kind of like the Clipper is now. Dad, through his role, was involved with Group 4 Securitas, who were Mike's sponsor at the time. And I think in that race, they won five out of the six legs and made friends for life. But a crazy way to go around the world in the Challenge 67s were great boats, heavy boats. I know they got the heck beaten out of them on more than one occasion, but just loved it. Absolutely loved it.
And made Mike Golding's reputation, really. That's where we first got to hear about him. That's where, you know, we started to notice him, and he managed to parlay that into, you know, Vendée Globe campaigns and you know, Extreme 40 campaigns.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the history with Mike and with Group 4, and then of course with Ekava, which was a company owned by the people that were involved with Group 4. Yeah, it worked perfectly, but it's the wrong way around for a reason. And it was pretty brutal. I know I speak to a lot of the people that were involved in that race, and they might not do it again.
Yeah, I mean, I know a few people who've done that race, and I know a few of the skippers, and it's interesting. I've always described it as a race for amateurs, because these people, it was the precursor to the Clipper, wasn't it? It was the first of these pay to race, pay to sail. And it was open to anybody from any walk of life. But actually, by the time they got to do the race, they'd had some pretty intensive training, hadn't they? I was schooled in that by Richard Tudor, who was one of the skippers. He was British Steel. And I wrote a story a long time ago about them being dismasted in the Southern Ocean. And when I interviewed him, I said, oh, so there you are, Richard, the only professional with all these amateurs. And he looked at me and he said, well, he said, how much sailing do you do each year? How many days sailing do you do? He said, all these guys have done way more than you'll ever dream of doing in a year by the time we got to do that race. So they were amateurs, but they were pretty well skilled back then as well.
It's fascinating. And I know when I speak to Dad about that race and I've spoken to Mike in the past, I know there was a really pretty serious conversation following 96, 97. About whether that team would go on and do a Whitbread campaign and try and take on the professionals, because those guys were guys and girls were fantastic. You had people like Mike, Dad, people like Alex Sizer, Ali Smith, people who have made fantastic names for themselves in the industry. If you look back and really figure out who's doing well in offshore sailing scene at the moment, you go back and a lot of them were involved in those early day challenge races. Murph Owen, who's of course a skipper. You look at people like JT, Jeremy Troughton, who's with JC Pindar now and has a huge amount of experience. Those guys were good. And I think the other thing about amateurs, particularly as I'm seeing now in the class 40 side of things, really amateurs are just people that are clever enough to have jobs. The vast majority of exceptional sailors, and I'd get shot for saying it, but a few of them are better than the professionals, but their passions lie in their work, and sailing is a hobby, but my God, they're good.
Yeah, good point. It certainly was a proving ground, and we've seen the success of the Clipper race, which does it slightly differently. It strikes me that it's always a little bit of a different approach to it. I'm not going to compare one with the other. But we've also seen in recent years a real spate of round the world races. I seem to get a different press release from somebody, you know, a couple of months, and I'm like, now is this the one I've already heard of? Is this new? And some of them fall by the wayside and some of them succeed. But there is something about racing around the world in whatever boat, whether it's a small vintage boat, as we see with one of the races in particular, or with the ocean race at the top end of the sport, or with your race, which we're going to come on to in a while. What do you think it is that attraction for around the world racing?
I think there's probably a few things, and firstly, probably sorry for sending too many press releases, There's a couple of things. You can never escape the romance and the authenticity of being either alone or as part of a team at sea, getting the crap kicked out of you, being scared to the wits of your life, but having the most spectacular time. There's that purity and that authenticity to it that I think is probably something that we are longing for. And I think that's probably why we've seen a huge amount of success in what Don's been doing with the, and I have to get the names right because you're right, there are so many, the Golden Globe race and the Ocean Globe race. Why I think that is going to be so successful. You've then got people like Marco Nannini, who set up the Global Solo Challenge, which is for a multitude of boats. It's slightly more of a rally, but my God, it'll be a race as soon as the gun goes off, albeit at different times for different people. It's the authenticity and the purity of it for me that you just can't escape.
And it's adventure, isn't it? I mean, there's a thrill and an adventure to racing across oceans, but to race around the world is everybody's dream. It's my dream. It's probably the dream of most people listening to this podcast. It's likely to be unfulfilled for 99% of us, but it is there in all of us. So when we hear about these races, you do immediately think, I wonder whether I could do that. I wonder.
But don't you just think with the, particularly the stuff that Don's doing, that there's a slight chance that you could do it?
Yeah.
And I think that is probably what captivates people so much is you go, yeah, hold on. I mean, the Volvo maybe is, or the ocean races, perhaps out of reach. But maybe I could go around the world in a Rustler 36 or a Class 40 and do this. And I think that the ability to perhaps touch that dream is pretty cool and is a pretty powerful one.
Now, we're going to get onto the race itself in a sec, but I think that maybe the final point to make is, and I want to get your view on this, the COVID-19 pandemic, we're all coming out of it very much changed, I think, by our experience. You know, everybody's had, I don't think anybody had a good experience through it, other than maybe Jeff Bezos with his millions through Amazon. But for the rest of us, it's been pretty challenging, and we're all living a slightly different life now. Do you think that's triggered something in people, that these adventure type competitions are just more popular than they would have been previously?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's that element of understanding. Sailing for a lot of people has always been this sport, or in my view, that people can't necessarily get to grips with. With Formula One, okay, most people drive a car, but not everybody sails a boat. And I think very much with what we saw in the Vendée Globe, was that these skippers are at sea for 70 days, 100 days, however long it might be for each competitor. But now the people at home also know how it feels to be alone, how it feels to not be able to hug that loved one or this, that, and the other. So I think that there's that realization now of what people go through. But there's also, again, what we saw from Vendée, was that kind of, we're all in captivity, as some people call it. I mean, being in France at the time was I can only imagine being like living in occupied France. It was terrifying with the amount of paperwork we all had. But you'd see these 34 skippers go out there to sail around the world. And I was very fortunate to be involved with Miranda Meron's campaign. I've been with Miranda now for 11 years or so. And when she came back, I remember saying to her, you realise what you've just done? You've sailed around the world nonstop, single-handed. I've not been to the pub once. it's just unbelievable. You just can't figure it out. So I think, yeah, it's been a real boost for our sport, perhaps to the detriment of other sports. We were lucky that the Vendée Globe is probably the most COVID-safe event that you can find. But, yeah, it's I think that although a huge amount of events have found it hard, the long-term effect will be positive for us.
I think you're right. Now, let's talk about it then. The race around, I've been researching it. I know a little bit about it, but I want you to tell the story of, first of all, what it is, and then how did you come up with the concept for it?
Yeah. We're, it's a race we're massively excited about. The race around is... in essence, a traditional multi-stage around the world yacht race in class 40. It can be raced either solo or double-handed. And the course is, as I mentioned, traditional. West of France, down to Cape Town, across the Indian into the Pacific, where we'll either stop off in New Zealand or in Australia, before rounding the horn up to South America, again, most likely Brazil, before returning to France around 6 months later. And it's a race that's open to amateurs and professionals. I think that with Class 40 and where it stands today, there is that fantastic amateur-professional split. So we've got people like Ian Lipinski, two-time winner of the Mini Transat, winner of, he's won everything, racing alongside people like Catherine Poor, who would definitely be offended if I called her an amateur. I mean, she's fantastic and has won just as much. But it is, it's that hopefully accessible race that allows people to continue after the route de rum, or provide themselves a progression in offshore sailing that doesn't mean Vendée Globe budgets. So it's kind of that halfway house, but very much built on the old around alone BOC type event.
And we should say this is scheduled to start in 2023, so it's a little way off at this point. But in terms of building a campaign, that's not a massive amount of time, is it?
No, it doesn't feel like it. it's a little bit mad. And when we spoke about COVID earlier, and while we don't want the whole podcast to be about COVID, the setbacks with regards to understanding host city relationships has been interesting. But quite rightly, municipalities and cities should be talking about keeping schools and hospitals open, as opposed to a few little boats that are going to compete in Sam's race. So,
yeah, no, and I saw you made that point in an interview on Sailing Anarchy, which, and it's a good point, and it's a point I've heard from other race organisers, that, you know, even the bigger ones, it is a valid point. However, I do think all of these cities, once they're through COVID and once they're through the pandemic and the effects of that, are going to be looking for something that says we're open for business, and, you know, this type of race, you couldn't get anything better, could you? A big sporting event coming to your town.
No, you're absolutely right, and the bidding process has certainly picked up. And I mean, we went from struggling to make contact with various governments or city officials to all of a sudden being, oh, heck, okay, right, well, this person wants this, this person is able to deliver this, what's best for us, where do we want to be? So we're in this great place now where we're able to almost choose where we want to go, which is not a situation that is always the case, and particularly in France, where you've got 18,000 different levels of bureaucracy and people you've got to speak to. But yeah, we're in a good position with that.
So it's based around the Class 40, and a lot of people listening to the podcast will know all about the Class 40. But for those who don't, why the Class 40, and what is it about that boat that makes it the right boat for your race?
I think there's probably a few reasons. To start, I guess the Class 40 is a 40-foot monohull, made out of fiberglass as opposed to carbon. Carbon is only allowed in the mast, mast and boom, and sprit. And it's really a class that has built itself upon controlling costs, being accessible, or as accessible as a 40-foot racing yacht can be, whilst also competing in legendary races like the TJV and the Route de Rhum. So it's the perfect platform. And I think that where the class is today, I mean, hull number 174 was given out today to Lalu Racleol, which is a Lombard design, fantastic piece of kit. And we've got another 10 to 15 boats being built currently, it's a class that's in its ascendancy. 50 boats competing in the TJV, which is starting later this year. 55 boats in the upcoming Route de Rhum. The class had asked for 70. It's just such a strong class. And I think that for those that know Class 40, they will know that, that the type of race that the race around is has been tried before. Josh Hall tried in 08-09 and then again in 11-12 with the Global Ocean Race. And really, we're running a very similar race. But I think that if you look at where the class was back then and you look at where the class is today with not only competitors but design of boats, boats that are now doing 430 miles a day. It's just stonking. Our old Class 40, 147, Compagnie de France, was certainly quicker than our Amoka 60 that we raced around the world in the Vendée Globe. And you can do this on 10% of a budget that an Amoka would cost. So there's a multitude of reasons why we believe the Class 40 is the perfect platform for it.
And it's, as I understand it, it's part of the ethos of the Class 40, isn't it, to be raced around the world. They haven't been as of yet. As you say, there's been a couple of stumbles attempting to get those races organised. So this would be the first one where the boats race around the world, and it would be kind of a fulfilment of the design brief, I guess.
Yeah, they were always built with Cat Zero in mind. And it's, a couple of boats did finish the Global Ocean Race. Back in 08-09, I think Boris Herman in the 08-09 race. So yeah, they're absolutely built for it, but haven't quite reached their potential in a around the world capacity since. And I guess this comes slightly on to how this all came about and started. Alvard Mabir, who is the class president and has been for quite some time, also a legend of offshore sailing. Six Whitbreads, 35 racing transatlantics. He's done everything. If you give him some Calvados, he'll tell you his stories of navigating ferry back in the day, and you just think, Christ, Alvard, he knows his, he's just brilliant. We started talking back in 2017, actually, and that's where we were saying, right, well, we need to bring this back. We need to get something going here. And the thought of the class was very much that they were lacking a signature event to call their own. There's slightly, and the class might shoot me for saying this, but they've got a slight inferiority complex about the fact that they make up the majority of the fleet in the TJV. They make up the majority of the fleet in the Route de Rhum. But once the old teams arrive, once the Amokas arrive, to an extent, they're forgotten about, rightly or wrongly. So they really wanted an event they could call their own. We registered the domain name in 2017. We set up the social pages in 2017 and sat on it for a little bit. There was then a change in the Class 40 board, and me and Hugh Piggin, my colleague who's based in the States, were asked to do a feasibility study on whether this could be done from a technical point of view. Can the boats do it? Do the teams want it? Do the cities want it? Do the sponsors want it? And we came back with the findings and thought, yes, right, we need to do this. And here we are today, 2 years after launching, 2 years to go, and we set our goal for 2023 and back in 2019, so we could get everything right or as close to right as possible, because there's a lot of work that goes into it. And I think that what's taken us the time so far has been that we want to build a race for the long term. Everything we've been doing has been, okay, 2023 is coming, but how does this fit into 2027? How does this fit into 2031? And that's been exciting and challenging, but I think we're there.
And how does the funding work for this? Is it based around the host cities stumping up a bunch of cash? Is it sponsor driven? How does it work?
Yeah, so our model is slightly different to most people. It's certainly different to the French, who is majority municipality funded. We certainly want to be and are a race that is looking much more at commercial sponsorship. The entire race budget's just under 9 million euros, of which we expect 80% to be from commercial partners. Host cities, yes, absolutely have their part to play, but the majority of that is value in kind. The economic model of host cities paying for things, I think, is perhaps one that is becoming more outdated now. I certainly hope it is. I find it difficult. And the commercial relationships are certainly much cleaner, harder to get, but much cleaner when you do. And I think that the other point about it is that as Hugh and I have been involved in team management, we want to look after our competitors. There is an entry fee, but that's set at 5,000 euros. It's not significant. And we want our competitors to understand that it's them that allow us to do what we do. So by charging them an obscene amount of money, it seems somewhat counterintuitive.
And in terms of the team that will organise this, can you give us some idea of the scale of that and how that's organised?
Yeah, absolutely. It's every day when every week when we do team meetings, there's more and more people added to it, which is great. But it also means there's more and more people added to the payroll, which is scary. The way it's set up is kind of twofold. We have the onshore side of things who look after the overall management of the race from a commercial and media and team point of view. And then we have our on the water race direction team. We've just signed a contract with our race director. We can't yet, well, dependent upon when this goes out, say who it is. But people will be, we've got the best in the world as far as we're concerned. And that's something that we're excited about. So there's 11 of us at the moment, three or four looking after the marketing and commercial side, four looking after the racing side itself, one with the class, and two in sustainability.
And is there an HQ somewhere, or are you guys all working from home? Are you working from kind of remotely and doing this whole thing on Zoom right now?
Yeah, or Google Meets or Trello or Monday or whatever other bloody one there is. No, we're all very much remote. There absolutely will be a base. In fact, I go to Lorient next week where we have one of our first full team meetings of the last 18 months. But we've got people in Italy, France, Hughes in Newport, Rhode Island in the States. I'm in the UK, but spent a lot of time in France. So yeah, it's been remote up until now, but we're looking forward to getting to see each other again.
Yeah, and you've just released, I think last week or maybe the week before, the preliminary notice of race. That's a big moment for a race, isn't it? Because that kind of means here it is, guys. See what you think and tell us if you want to enter.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I mean, first and foremost, writing a notice of race is just hellish, particularly for a round the world race in category zero. It's bonkers, and men have to translate it into French, and it is nuts. But it is very much, as you say, that moment of, right, well, here we are. And all the talk on the pontoons and all the talk in the bar goes out the window, because you're either in or you're not. And I mean, I've been running races now for 10 years or so, which has been great. But with this one, it was very much, oh Christ, well, what happens if no one applies?
Yeah.
We've all already increased the number of boats that we're able to have, because the level of interest is such. But you do have that moment of self-doubt, and you think, yeah, buggers, has this all been for nothing? Is this going to work, or is this going to flop all of a sudden? But we're we've got entries, so we're really happy about that. It's nice that the talk is backed up by people wanting to do it.
Yeah, and I'm sure you were nervous about throwing a party and nobody comes, but I'm sure you also knew you had a bunch of people that had said, "Yeah, I'm in for this, and I'm going to do it." Now you haven't shared the entry list yet, and I can understand why you wouldn't do that, but the target number is 35 across double-handed and single-handed, with I think you said a 15, 15 per category, if you like, and then 5 wild cards. That's how you set it up.
It absolutely is, and to be honest, the target is probably 25, but we can accept 35, and I wouldn't be surprised if we got 35, which is fantastic. And yeah, to split the fleet into solo and double has been an interesting one. I think when I speak to a lot of the guys and girls in Lorient or in France, it's, "Sam, we want a solo race. What's all of this double-handed stuff about?" But they often forget that the competitors from perhaps the UK or the States particularly, double-handed is where they want to go. And I think we all know over the last 18 months that the double-handed category has been the largest growth of the sport, whether that's down to its little foray into the Olympics or not, no one really knows. But yeah, we've separated it as 15 in each class with 5 wild cards that we can play as we want.
And what can you tell us about the profile of these entrants? I mean, across both categories, you know, I'm trying to picture who these people are. Are they, you know, is it going to be mainly pro teams? Is it going to be mainly amateur teams? In your mind, what does it look like?
It's interesting. So I think we'll see a split. And I think that split will be the solo and double-handed categories. Although the first competitor to officially enter was Lalu Racliol, who we haven't announced yet, but it's pretty well known that he's going to be at the race, has entered in the double-handed category. And when you look back at his career and what he did with Bank Pop back in the day and now with the Ocean 50 class, as they're calling it, he's probably a statement of the type of competitor that we're attracting. We're certainly seeing some people that are very much on their path to the Vendée Globe in perhaps 2028, but are coming in and looking to prove themselves. At the moment, as it stands, we will have mini Transat winners. We will have people that have podiumed within the Figaro. We will have people that have raced the Vendée Globe and have now stepped back. And Class 40 is that awesome category that attracts people like Quito de Pavon, that attracts people like Ian Lipinski, the best of a mocker stepping back, perhaps coming to, I don't want to say the end of their careers, but their twilight years, looking for one last big hurrah. And then you've got the guys and girls that are using the class as a platform to step up to the Vendée perhaps in 4 years' time. So it's that real class of transition. And I think this is one of the reasons why the race will have such success, is because once a team has done the mini transat, well, where do you go? You go to the Route du Rhum. Once you've done the Route du Rhum, well, where do you go? You go to the Vendée. If you want to win it, €7 million boat build, €3 million a year running cost, or you jump into the Class 40, which you can now do the TJV, the Route du Rhum, and race around the world for a boat that costs €700,000 with a running cost of €300,000. And I think the general public, I mean, the Amokas are sexy. They always will be. But I guess it'd be interesting to get your point of view as well, is that to a lot of people, a boat is a boat. Whether it's a Class 40 or an Amoka 60, you're still racing around the world on a monohull. And my thoughts kind of sometimes are that actually people don't really care.
I think people don't necessarily care. I mean, they love the, you know, the Chirals of this world and the Hugo Bosses. They also love Pit Hairs, you know, much older boat going around the world. But they love the competition. And for me, what appeals to me about your race is the idea of having 20 plus of these teams, individuals, double-handed competitors, just going at it around the world. I think that is amazing. And, you know, you look at the ocean race, you know, I think I'm not really going to upset anybody if I said, you know, if they got six in each fleet, they'd be pretty happy with 12 boats in there, you know, across the Amoca 60 and the VO 65, they'd consider that to be a decent fleet for them. It would be the biggest fleet they've had in a long time. But, you know, you're going to be almost double that if you get near your kind of target number in your mind.
Yeah. And you're right. I think pleased is one word. I think they might be ecstatic if they get those numbers. But I mean, I sincerely hope they do, because there's absolutely a place for that race. But you're right. The thing that always amazes me is just the difference in funding. For us to run a race with 35 boats, and as I mentioned earlier, 35 high performance boats with some really good names involved, we're looking at a campaign cost of just under 9 million euros. You can't run one boat in a Vendée Globe for that. You certainly couldn't do it in an ocean race kind of format. So yes, we might be a smaller race with smaller budgets, but I think there's a lot to be said for that. So sometimes these big budgets events are the downfall of themselves, because the numbers just get so big.
So let's talk about that budget, because that was going to be my next question. So you're saying 9 million to do the race. So is that 9 million over, you know, starting today and finishing when you finish the race, or is that for somebody tipping up 6 months before the race?
That's the overall race budget.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
No, don't worry. In terms of the team budgets, and we've actually just finished this exercise, so it's a good, well-timed question. We're looking at between 350 and 400,000 euros. Now, that doesn't include boat build or boat charter, but that does include the new set of sails that you're going to want to buy. That does include insurance as you go around the world, your freeze-dried, your hotel rooms when you're on land. And, okay, there's qualifying to go into it and that kind of thing, but for the race itself, between 350 and 400 grand.
Wow. So, yeah, God, I did misunderstand that. I guess I should have been thinking 9 million is quite a lot, isn't it, for a 40-foot boat to race around the world?
it is, but you could buy 9 class 40s or 1 Amoca 60. I know what I'd have. Well, I'd be useless on an Amoca 60 anyway. I wouldn't know what to do. But the scales are just monumental. And I'll do an awful plug for a piece of content that we have on our website. But we broke down maybe a month ago or so the record-breaking price per knot of Class 40 of Amoca and of the old team. And the figures were staggering. I can't remember off the top of my head, but Boss has got the record for 24 hours in Amoca at about 570 miles. And each knot would have cost them around 300,000 euros. In Class 40, I think the average speed was about 18.2 knots, and it was 39,000. And there's a difference of 130 miles. And okay, around the world, that's a huge amount. But these boats are not slouches.
I need to look at that. That's a good way of doing it. Actually, it's a very cheeky way of doing it, really, I guess.
Yeah, it is. We've got a few more of them coming. We're not out to upset anybody, but just pound for pound, I mean, I'm massively biased. I love this class. I've been involved for 12 years or so now. But pound for pound, for me, they're certainly the best shorthanded offshore racing boat, if not best offshore racing boat there is.
Yeah, well, borne out by the success of the class and the number of boats that have been built, as you mentioned earlier. So tell me, for these campaigns, what are we looking at in terms of a team structure? Are we expecting this to be the skipper stroke skippers maintaining their own boats around the world, or will people take shore crew? Will they have a team manager? Will there be a weather router? You know, is it going to be done like the Volvo teams used to do?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and unfortunately, there's not one answer for it. Everybody's going to be doing it their way, and there is that element of kind of class mini spirit within Class 40. Yeah, Ian Lipinski is going to bring a preparateur with him. He's got his team at home, but are running the media side of things. He's got the sponsorship managers. It's a very professional campaign, as it should be when you're sponsored by the fourth largest bank in France. But then you've got people like Axel Treyer, who's just launched his new boat, a boat that he built basically by himself in his shed. He will probably have a preparator, and his partner will be around. And then there's a sliding scale all the way back. There'll be competitors that will be sleeping on their boats because either they can't afford a hotel or because actually the boat is home and that's where they want to be. So it's kind of a sliding scale. But one thing that we as organisers are doing is we are providing a couple of workshop containers and centralising to nowhere near the extent of a boatyard in the ocean race, but providing at least the ability for teams to do work themselves and connecting people up with local specialists. So perhaps someone's got rigging issues in New Zealand. Well, we'll hook them up with the go-to local team there.
But not to the extent of the ocean race, which carries a set of spare masts for the 65s. You wouldn't go that far. That would be the responsibility of the competitors themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, and it's one that we're trying to figure out at the moment. At the moment, we're on the side of probably that's the competitor's responsibility. But it's one that we're talking about pretty seriously, particularly being that most Class 40 rigs are made by one company. It's something that we're looking at, but no decision has been made yet.
Yeah, because I mean, you want as a race organizer, you want as many boats to finish the legs as possible. That's where the sponsor gets the best value. The race gets the best press. And it's just better for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Success is definitely measured by the amount of boats that finish as opposed to start. But I think that the other thing that the 40s have got, which makes life a lot easier, is that they really are very simple boats. We have no canting keel. We have no foils. We have no daggerboards. We have a relatively rudimentary water ballast system. The boats are glass fibers, so in terms of any composite work, you don't have the challenges associated with carbon. They're just fantastic bits of kit, and you can use them and abuse them, and my God, they'll look after you. But there's that simplicity in them that doesn't affect performance. It hasn't affected performance because the design teams now are just so good.
And the design itself, I mean, I've seen quite an evolution in this class, but as you say, we've seen scow bows and that sort of thing emerging, as we've seen across other fleets as well. Is there going to be, kind of a big difference between the boats at the front of the fleet and the boats at the back? Are we going to see people finishing weeks behind?
So, I mean, the straight answer is it is possible. Let's say, for instance, we have a Sam Menard design Mach 4 against an Acalaria one or an old Pogo one from 2008. Yes, there'll be some pretty big discrepancies in speed and average speed, more importantly. Again, it's something we're trying to work out quite how we deal with it. We never want to be a race that doesn't accept entries of boats past X years. It's something that a few people are pushing for quite hard. I don't quite agree with it, but that is certainly a challenge. Certainly a challenge.
And on kind of leading on from that, how do you make sure everybody is of a safe standard? I mean, there must be, you want to be inclusive, but you also don't want to send somebody out there who clearly just isn't up to competing in a race like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have a pretty rigorous qualification structure that goes in place. And what we're asking competitors is that we want to see at least one transatlantic race in the configuration in which they're racing in. We will also take a common sense approach to it. So, for instance, and the names I'll use have got no association to the race at all. But if Jean Le Cam turns up and says, "Look, do you know what, Sam? Actually, I'm dying to do this." Well, his qualification process might be slightly different from Tom, Dick, or Harry that have just done Fastnet on a 30-foot Beneteau. So, yes, there's things that we have and there are structures in place to allow us as organisers to accept an entry or more importantly, not. But we will also use common sense as and where appropriate.
Understood. Now, the course itself, I know it's not finalised and the cities are not in place, but we know roughly where the boats are going to be going. And it's easy when we're sitting on a podcast talking about racing around the world, we say, oh yeah, we leave France and we go down to Cape Town. I mean, that's not an insignificant leg in itself, but from Cape Town round to Australia or New Zealand, I mean, that's the old Whitbread leg, right? I mean, that's in much bigger boats, that was a daunting leg. So two questions. One is, how daunting is it going to be in a 40-foot boat? And the second one is, like, how long are you expecting the boats, the fleet, to take to make that that trip through the Southern Ocean? Because I think it's going to be weeks, isn't it?
It will be weeks. Currently, for
maybe even a month, right?
So for leg two, which is currently Cape Town across to Australia, New Zealand, we're looking at 32 days. From a routing that we've done, and we've done that on an average class 40, which is always what we want to be looking at. Routing on the fastest boat only sets you up for a significant fail later. So we're looking at 32 days. The following leg around the Horn, we're looking at 35 days. It's a long time. I would say that probably the speeds that the newer, faster boats are going to be doing will beat some of the old Whitbread times. Yeah. In fact, I'm almost certain of that and quite excited by the prospect. But look, the South is brutal. It's not somewhere I've been. But our race direction have been there and seen it and have experience of getting people out of pretty sticky situations. But I think the thing for me is that post Vendée Globe, when I was speaking to a lot of the guys and girls that have just come out of that, is that they were longing for the Southern Ocean when they were coming back into the North Atlantic. That short, sharp chop and these North Atlantic depressions that are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more unstable and just bizarre, particularly as you're coming up into Biscay, where a huge change in levels, they were longing for the South. And this isn't to say in any way that the South is a good place to be, but these scow bow boats that now carry good speed on those longer wave sets, we're pretty confident, and we've asked a lot of the 60 sailors that have got Class 40 experience, of which I think there was 18 in this Vendée Globe that came out of Class 40 or touched it in some way. Like, guys, is it? What do you reckon? Are the 40s capable? Not one came back and said no.
Right.
Which for me was very reassuring. Of course, it's sailing and it's a mechanical sport, and God, if we get through leg two and leg three without any problems, I'll be the happiest man alive. But we're pretty happy that the boats are able to withstand that and actually might face more challenging conditions in the North Atlantic.
Okay, understood. How will the fans be able to follow this race? Because, you know, the one thing that has been done really well with, you know, by the Ocean Race in particular is this, the media coverage, you know, onboard media men. People are used to that now. They're used to live trackers. They're used to being able to basically see everything that's going on the boat. Not everything, but it feels like that sometimes. How will you stack up in that department?
I mean, I'm not going to beat around the bush. We're not the Ocean Race. And we will never be in a position to put onboard reporters on the boats or within the boats. For the crewed stuff, I think it's fantastic, but I think it really changes the makeup of a team when you are either alone or with another. So there won't be that dedicated person. But as a race, we'll be working very hard with teams to teach them how to use drones to provide the internet connections and perhaps more importantly, data to allow them to send back high quality, high definition footage and audio pieces. And of course, some of the written content that comes off. I think that when I look back at some of my favorite bits of content that's come off boats, and the Ocean Race, as an example, is it was Dee wrote in the last race, or race before, about making a cup of tea in the Southern Ocean. It was about 200 words of prose, and it was just fantastic. And that told me a huge amount more than another drone photo, albeit of another boat. That really romantic element of writing is something that we will use pretty heavily.
I'm glad to hear it. You're a man after my own heart.
I'm slightly old fashioned. It's but the written content, some of it is just breathtaking. But we will have video, we will have photo. But if people are expecting a Ocean Race style production, they're probably going to be disappointed.
But maybe you can take from the Vendée Globe and, you know, what they did particularly well with Andy Robertson's kind of daily show, and again that's a big budget commitment to do something like that, but you know, just being able to call the boats and talk to them, is that feasible?
Absolutely. And I mean, in this last Vendée, the ability to use WhatsApp, I mean, it was just mental. I'd be out walking my dog in the New Forest and I'd get a text from Miranda, who's in the Southern Ocean having the crap kicked out of her. We spoke to each other on New Year's Eve. And I'd have better connection speaking to her in the Southern Ocean than I would my partner 2 minutes down the road. So what we're able to do with WhatsApp now is unbelievable, and it is a game changer. And you've also got these things coming to the fore, like Starlink, which is Elon Musk's new no latency internet for everywhere. The advances in technology are just unbelievable. So we'll be able to do a huge amount. Live shows are part of the equation, albeit slightly differently, as are things like this, podcasts. I mean, when you look at what people are engaging with and what people digest, podcasts are hugely high up there. You listen to them in the car, you're on your way to work, you're walking the dog. They're fantastic, just great.
You're preaching to the converted here. Now, I couldn't let you be a guest on the podcast without talking about the sustainability angle of this race, because we, and I know somebody, if you're listening, please don't reach for the off button. because sometimes sustainability can be one of those things that everybody has to talk about, and everybody has to have a sustainability standpoint. And what I like about your race is that it's all a little bit different, isn't it? Because of the Class 40 and the fact that it's built from kind of traditional materials, if you like, compared with carbon and all of that, it gives you some opportunities. So the Futures program that is part of the race, tell us about that.
Yeah, it's one of the things we're most excited about. And again, look, every race does have to have some form of sustainability element to it now, whether that's true sustainability in terms of environmental or diversity or education. But what we've been able to do is very much look at fiberglass and a significant problem within the marine sector with regards to end of life of boats, and also evolution in design. Because the least sustainable thing about a mechanical sport is new designs. If an old design becomes outdated, then all of a sudden your investment is obsolete, and you've got a whole chunk of boat that's going to sit there and not do overly much. But working with the wind industry, the automotive industry, we're able to look at ways of how we can build boats differently. And we're very lucky with Class 40 that the rules haven't been changed in 10 years. So we're able to integrate new technology or fiberglass replacements into a boat build, and then fully recycle it when it does reach its end of life. And when I say fully recycle, I mean fully recycle, cradle to cradle. Restore fibers back to virgin fibers and create a new boat out of the material used for the first boat. And how we're using the Futures program as a living case study, and actually going out and doing it. We are about to start the build of our Class 40 in this new and innovative way. It's hugely exciting, and the marine industry is just one segment of it. If you look at what we're doing and how wind turbines are built, how glass fiber is used elsewhere, it's really game changing, and that's exciting. But we're very much about yacht racing has done very well to ride on the coattails of sustainability for so long. We've become a little bit fed up with it, so we want to do it, and that's what we want our sustainability program to be. It might be a massive cock up. The boat might fall apart, but we want to try, and that I think is where things are really exciting.
So let's just be clear on what you're talking about here. So you guys, the event itself, so the organisers are building a Class 40 using recyclable materials, and that boat will be raced in the race itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So long as all trials go as expected and
the boat
break up. But yeah, that's very much the plan. But the plan will also be post race around to dismantle it, to recycle it, and to build a second boat out of the same materials that we built the first.
I mean, that is really very different, isn't it? I mean, I don't, you know, that is what I call putting your money where your mouth is.
It is, and it's great. But also sailing has this wonderful opportunity to be that living case study for industries that far exceed what we do. We're working very closely with the energy sector, particularly wind, because if these materials can race around the world, they can be subjected to UV, to salt, to constant low impact. I mean, it's the harshest environments in the world. They'll certainly work on a wind turbine. And that how you mold R&D and traditional marketing spend and how industries can give back to one another, that's where it's exciting. And to be honest, that's where most of our budget for the race is found, is in R&D and what we're able to do as a platform and a test bed for new technology as opposed to traditional marketing spend.
And are you finding you're kind of pushing against an open door here with in terms of partnering with people? Because I'm sure people want to be part of this. You describe it as a test bed, and it is. It's a great chance to find out whether this stuff actually works, right?
Yeah, or as I mentioned, it goes really badly wrong.
And yeah.
Everyone looks like a plonk at the end of it. But the only thing I'd say about that is at least we've tried. I can't attend another one of these forums, and they're great. They have a place. But we've built the race around on one word, really, and that's the word real. Whether that's the competitors, the boats, the futures program, we want to get out there and get our hands dirty and see what we can do. And partners, they get it, they understand it, and they want to be a part of it, which is great. But raising funds for things for racing boats around the world is always going to be tricky. But what I would say is that probably there's never been a better time than now. And there have never been more doors open than there are today. I think you look at France, we've got 14 newer Mockers being built the year after a Vendée Globe. Unheard of. Mm. We've got 27, I think it is, Class 40s that have been built in the last year and future. 35 Class Minis, two old teams that have come out of the shed relatively recently. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And the great article on Tip and Shaft, the French newsletter about the boom that you've just described in offshore racing, and it's creating a skills shortage. There's not enough skilled people to build all these boats, which is a kind of a nice problem for the sport to have. It seems like it's based around L'Orient and that kind of that marine technology valley down there. But nice problem to have.
It is.
For you, Sam, you know, you've got your team of 11 people. I'm sure it'll expand as the race goes forward. I know you're working really hard on this, and it's long days. We're recording this at it's nearly 10 o'clock at night where I am and 9 o'clock where you are in the UK. What are the milestones now for you? I suspect even though the race is a while away, there's some key milestones coming up that are going to be really important for you.
Yeah, they absolutely are. There's, of course, the notice of race or pre-notice of race, which has just been published. That's a big one. All of a sudden, I always say to the guys, look, we're a website at the moment. We're not anything else. But now the notice of race is out there. There's something there. There's some structure to it. The next big milestone will be the announcement of our race director. Really, that's a public milestone because contracts are already signed.
When might we expect that?
Probably just prior to the TJV.
Okay.
So the first week of November. That I hope will be quite a big splash. We've done a really really good job with that. I'm not quite sure how we've pulled it off, but we have. Then the next milestone will be host city announcements. We hope, and well, the notice of race stipulates that will be before December 31st of this year. With French politics, you never know if it's going to be a week or a year. But we're in good conversations with three cities there, and all three bids are built for the long term. As I say, I'm in L'Orient next week. L'Orient is one of the cities. There's two others as well. And from there, it's I guess confirmation of final budget. But as we stand today, we have the money to run a round the world race. We are all systems go. It's not yet the budget that I want to run a race, but it's a budget we can. Right. So it's no longer a matter of if this happens. It's it is going to happen, and that's a hugely exciting and terrifying feeling. what have we let ourselves in for? yeah, so a few milestones to go, but we're in a pretty strong place.
For me, the most exciting time will be when you can announce the entry list, and we can see, you know, who these crazy people are who are going to race around the world. You know, a lot of them, I would imagine, are doing it for the first time. I think that'll be exciting, and it'll, you know, the stories that will come out of that will just feed more and more interest for you as the, you know, in the interim between the race starting. Because I guess people are building boats, you know, for the race, and they're going to do, you know, all of that campaign warm up is going to be exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. We are very much approaching that exciting phase. And I think that perhaps sometimes people think that we withhold information for fun. And I mean, we're just as dying as anybody else to announce some of the competitors, but we have to align with their sponsors' needs, requirements, or the calendar itself. I mean, there's been one sponsor in particular that has been signed for 6 months now. Like, yeah. Guys, come on, it's time to talk about it. But there's pushback. But no, we're in a great place. There's 6 class 40s being launched in the next 2 weeks. Not all will be coming to the race around. Let's be clear on that. But it's we're at that human part of boat builds and seeing campaigns right the way through from conception to execution, which is something that I think I've always really enjoyed.
So give the website a plug. You're just about to move from being a website to a race. You've done that in the last week. So give the website a plug anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find us at www.theracearound.com. And on all the usual social media channels, again, at The Race Around. And I think the final thing, or one of the final things for me to say, is that we're always here to answer questions. That engagement with either potential competitors or fans is really important to us. And things for us will very much be open source. Sailing instructions and notice of race will be available for all to see. So we're hopefully catering for the diehard sailing fans that want to know what we're doing with RSO 55 or the real intricate rules alongside traditional sports fans.
That's great. Well, Sam, I think you could probably tell, I think it's a fantastic initiative. I'm very excited that it's happening. I think you've done amazingly well to get it done, given the world's been through in the last couple of years. So congratulations on that. And thanks so much for spending the time. And after, I'm sure you've had a long day. Thanks for talking to me. I'm sure the listeners will enjoy it. And let's try and catch up again, you know, maybe in the new year once we've got some competitors announced.
No, absolutely. It's been a real pleasure. And Justin, always happy to chat and answer questions or just talk about boats. It's great.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks go to Sam Holliday for taking the time at the end of a very long workday to speak to me. Thanks also to all of you listeners for joining us too. I'll be back soon with another episode, but until then, I'll just say as usual, sail fast, everyone.